From Nashville, Tennessee, this is The Pivot, stories of people who've made a change. Welcome to The Pivot. My name is Andrew Osinga, and my guest today is Dan Hasseltine. I've known Dan for a long time. I knew him before he knew me because he was in Jars of Clay when I was in high school. And I actually saw them when they were still a college band. They were brand new. They went on stage and started playing, and I remember looking at my friends, and we thought, we could do this. And we started a band probably during their set. Just, all right, when we get home, we're going to start a band. And that changed the course of my life. It's a big deal. I had a poster of them on my wall in high school. I had a picture, a picture of me at one of their shows with braces on, wearing my Jars of Clay t-shirt over the shirt that I wore to the gig, with, you know, because I bought it there and had them sign it, you know. I was 15, I think, and I'm standing with Dan and Matt, who've since become just dear friends. And it's just, I've just this goober look on my face. It's awesome. And years later, we toured together, and I was on a bus with those guys for like 6 months, and I brought those pictures. We had them hanging up in the bus, and at the end of the tour, I forgot to grab them, and they just disappeared. So sad. But I'm a huge fan of the work that those guys did and that Dan did writing those Jars of Clay songs. I'm an even bigger fan of what Dan is doing now, and you'll get to hear about it. It's just beautiful. But before we go to the interview, I want to take a quick minute to let you know something really exciting that's happening right now. The organization that Dan started is called Bloodwater Mission. They are an amazing organization that has brought clean water to over 1 million people in Africa. They're digging wells and bringing all sorts of different economic and healthy initiatives to villages in Africa and saving so many lives. It's unreal that people I know started this. I can't get my mind around it. Someone else I know is my daughter, Sadie. She is 10 years old, and she learned about the water crisis in Africa in December, and she couldn't stop thinking about it and talking about it. We were on the way home from visiting family at Christmas, and from the back of the van, this voice pops up. I gotta do something. All right, what if I did a cartwheel every day this whole year, and I asked people to give me money, and all that money went to help kids in Africa who don't have clean water? We thought, that's wonderful. Let's make a little Instagram page, and you can try to raise a little money, and we can film and post these cartwheels every day. The day that this podcast releases is September 1st. As of that point, she will have done 240-some cartwheels. She will have also raised just over $4,000. Her goal for the year is $10,000. We actually have an anonymous person who has said that they will match any donations that go through Sadie's fundraising profile in the month of September. So if you give $10, that person will give $10. Which all goes towards helping kids in Africa get clean water. So if you go to Instagram at Clean Water Cartwheels, you'll find my daughter Sadie and her daily cartwheel. They're so fun, and all my kids are usually in them, and it's been one of the most fun things we've got to do this year as a family, and to know that little action we've taken has been able to help people across the world is a huge thing for me, but especially for my kids, to be a part of it and to know that things are possible. And so Dan's going to talk about that in a little bit. But before we got into the interview, I had to make sure you knew that if you want to help and you want to see cute kids doing cartwheels, go to Instagram, Clean Water Cartwheels. In the profile, there's a little donate link, and you can give through Sadie's profile there. We would love that. Okay, that's my spiel. And now for the reason that you actually clicked play. Here is my conversation with Dan. I should add that this was actually the first podcast that I ever recorded, and I did not hit record in time because I didn't know. And he started talking about how he was preparing for giving a graduation commencement speech at Greenville College, a college where he attended but did not graduate but holds an honorary degree. One of the many reasons Dan is my hero. All right, here is my wonderful conversation with the wonderful Dan Haseldine.
Pretty thick bubble. What do you want to say?
Yeah.
It's like the universe is right. It's, you know, oh, man. It's like, I want you to write a song about anything you want.
Yeah.
And no, you know, there's no prompt. So I felt like it was that. It was just like, so I wrote like 7 or 8 of these commencement addresses and felt like I finally got it. And then went to bed that night and the morning of the address, I'm like in my hotel room and I'm up at 6 a.m. going, oh, that wasn't it. It's not it yet. And so I'm frantically trying to figure out, okay, how can I do this? Because I'm not going to be able to read my writing, so there's no way I'm going to be able to just read it off.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people do in their commencement addresses. I'm like, I'm going to have to just do some bullet points and then riff and do it. And it actually turned out to be the best thing to do anyway. For me, that always is. I don't sit still when I'm speaking to people, and so yeah. It was better to just have some points and go, okay, I know where I'm going with each of these points. And just get out there. And I forgot that Greenville was so close to Ferguson, Missouri.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's like half an hour, right?
Yeah, it's close. And so, you know, for as much as the rest of us felt the wave of that, mm-hmm. They really felt it. And so there were students on campus that were holding protests. And kind of this, the racial tension on campus was really affected by it. And so I felt like it would not be honoring to those students to not mention anything.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to pull that in as well. So, but there were things like that I couldn't know until I got on campus and saw the way it was versus the last time I was there, which was 14 or 15 years ago. So it's been a long time.
It's been that long?
It had, yeah. Which is crazy. And that, yeah.
Yeah.
People were talking about the Agape Music Festival up there. It was crazy.
Yeah, well, this is a great way to start. This is actually where I was going to start this. Because the first time I met you years after I first saw you, but mm-hmm. first time I saw you was Agape 1994.
Wow.
I was a freshman in high school.
Yeah.
You guys were still students.
We were students, and that was the first year that our professor, Warren Bennett, mm-hmm. was like, all right. We won some sort of Battle of the Bands thing, and so we were like, all right, you get 15 minutes on stage at Agape Music Festival, which is a huge deal for us.
How many people were at that festival?
I have no
idea. 3,000?
A couple million.
But not at...
I'm sure millions.
At 9 in the morning.
Right, yeah. It was before all the bad weather came in. That was the thing about Agape Music Festival. It was always... The weather was always bad. It would be so nice leading up to it, but then that weekend of the festival... It would be hail and snow and rain and lightning and thunder. And it just was this sort of funny, funny little pocket every year, though. Bad weather.
That's, a lot of mud. I remember a lot of mud. But I remember seeing you guys play.
Yeah.
And you, still in college. So how long, at what point did you guys meet and start the band? Like, how did that even start?
Well, you know, we were all... going to school for music.
Okay.
And that was the big deal. Like Greenville College had a recording studio. It was a school that had a music program that they called, like, it was one of the first commercial music programs where they really were trying to figure out how do you have a music program that isn't just the traditional classical performance or jazz? And how do you add this technology piece in about recording, and so they were kind of ahead of their game on that. Certainly other schools like, you know, Berkeley and the music schools traditionally were doing that, but for a liberal arts college in the middle of Illinois, it was a pretty cutting edge thing. And so we were all part of this music program, and Charlie Lowell, our keyboard player, and I, we met just on campus. I was wearing a Toad the Wet Sprocket t-shirt, and he liked Toe the Wet Sprocket, and so we met kind of and found that we liked similar music, and then we met Matt Bronway, who was a Kansas boy who was also in the music program, guitar player, and we were in the, they require freshmen to be in these student ministries bands.
Okay.
And so we had to, you try out for them, and then you kind of, hopefully you make it in there, and you play a lot of shows at prisons and places like that for inmates, and you just do, it's all like cover songs. And if you're really, really lucky, they'll let you throw in an original piece of music, which I don't think we ever did. So,
but so were, was the Jars, was that one of those bands?
Jars, like yeah. So Charlie and Matt and I, we're in that initially. Now, Steve didn't show up until we were sophomores.
Okay.
So he came in a year later, and at that point, they had, we had already kind of done this year of touring with this group on campus, and the professors were saying, hey, we'd love to offer you guys the opportunity to do this again this year. And we all kind of looked at it and went, well, no, we want the freshmen to be able to have this opportunity like we did. And so we all said no, but we all wanted to make music together still. And so the three of us were in studio recording classes at that point. And that meant we had to write songs and then record them. And mm-hmm. we were graded on the recordings, not really on the songs. Yeah, which is really hard to do. Like, if you know, how do you do that? How do you, you know?
Yeah,
because if it's a great song, then it's going to be so compelling that you're not really going to listen to the production value necessarily.
Yeah,
because it'll transcend that. But we were in these classes, and that's where we had the opportunity to start writing as Jars. And it wasn't called that. It was they were just pieces of music, but we wrote like Fade to Gray was one of the first ones, and Love Song for a Savior and Like a Child. Those were all projects right away at the very beginning.
Which were all huge hits.
Right.
I mean, years later, but those were massive hits.
Yeah, and we even had, like, part of the process, they did do some critiquing of songwriting, so they would bring in a Nashville songwriter and mm-hmm. be like, hey, this guy's going to listen to your song and then kind of pull it apart,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a good exercise, sort of. But he came in and... We played him. We had just finished recording Like a Child, and we played it for him, and he just kind of tore it apart. And he's like, this song, you changed the lyrics on the chorus in the last chorus. You can't do that in a pop song. And he like had all these sort of rules about songwriting that he felt like we needed to know and why our song wouldn't make it. And Like a Child ended up becoming a number one single on radio. So it was sort of a funny thing. And I saw this songwriter years later, like in Nashville. We bumped into each other and had a good laugh over it.
That's awesome. Kind of
funny. Yeah.
Yeah. So you guys made, I know, your initial recording, which I bought that day that I first saw you guys in 1994 when you guys were, it was those demos, right? Those school mm-hmm. projects. And then 2 years later, you were playing in arenas.
Yeah.
How did that happen? What was that process like? I mean, you guys were on a rocket ship.
Yeah. Well, after we got back from the crossroads and making the deal with the devil. we took the first three recordings that we had, and we entered this Battle of the Bands competition.
Okay. Here in Nashville?
And it was, the contest was in Nashville. We were still in school in Illinois. But the ad for the performance competition was, you know, if send in $50 and your cassette tape. Now, for those out there listening, a cassette tape is a small rectangular piece of plastic with a tape inside of it that you put on a machine. But anyway, we put together a cassette tape with three songs on it. And really, the other part of it was they said an industry professional will critique your material.
Mm-hmm.
And we just wanted someone outside to really listen to it and go,
yeah,
is this good? Is there any merit to what we're doing? Should we be pursuing this at all? And so we sent in our submission for this competition. And a few weeks later, got a phone call that said, hey, you guys, you're one of the 10 finalists in this competition. So over spring break, we went down to Nashville and played in this competition and ended up winning it. And which it was funny to us because we had never played live. Like all of these songs, we
ever
were in, no, because
that
we
was
were
your first show. Was this
yes? Because we were all studio recording students, so we literally would sit in the studio and pluck these songs out, and then they would be recorded, and that was it. And there weren't a lot of opportunities to play around Greenville College those days, and so you know,
which is in a cornfield,
yes.
60 miles from St. Louis,
right? Yeah. So we didn't have any real performance experience with the Jars stuff. And so winning the competition was mind-blowing for us. Like we were completely shocked. But we didn't really know what it meant. We thought, "Oh, that was really fun. Great. Awesome." They said one of the things you win is you get to either sit in a meeting with the head of Word Records or you can have a fashion consultant meeting. And we chose the fashion consultant
you did
meeting.
Not.
Yes. So we thought,
what did you learn in that meeting?
Not very much, apparently, because we've, you know, Jars of Clay was voted worst haircuts in the music industry at one point, which is saying something because there are some pretty bad haircuts in the music industry.
Yes.
And we went through a shiny shirt phase and an orange pants phase. I mean, let's just say whatever that fashion consultant told us, and she was actually very capable and very good at what she did. We obviously didn't listen. So, yeah, we were in college, so we already knew everything.
Yeah. Was the point. We don't need to hear from the record executive.
Right.
We need to hear from the fashion, because really, who's going to get you girls?
Right, exactly. It's the fashion exec. Right. So we did that, went back to school, and just we're going to finish out the year, keep working on our music, and we kept getting these phone calls from different record labels. And they were just, you know, it was the typical phone call of, "Hey, so we heard some of your music, and we're really just curious to know what you want to do with that, and like, what are your ambitions?" And after about 7 or 8 of those phone calls from different labels, we thought, well, maybe after the end of the school year, we should just head down to Nashville, spend the summer there. If nothing happens, we can go back to school.
Yeah.
And so we went down at the end of the school year, all living in a single, you know, a two-bedroom apartment in Antioch area of Nashville, and worked at an Office Max remodeling the store from 9 at night until 7 in the morning, and then getting up and then taking meetings with record labels and different people in the industry to figure out what we were supposed to be doing. And what we ended up signing a deal with Essential Records, and that just kind of pushed us out the door. And it was kind of like we were shot out of a cannon from that moment on.
Yeah.
We went on tour really before the record was even done. We went out on the road with a great band, PFR, who just, for whatever reason, they were nice enough to take us out, even though we didn't have an album for sale or anything. Maybe it was good because it didn't compete with any of their merch sales. Then they're like, "Let's take the band that doesn't even have an album out." But they were great, and they taught us a lot about touring, what it was like to just, I mean, they would go out and hang out with their fans all the time. And they were one of those bands that music was really, it was a gift to other people. They were offering it to people rather than trying to figure out what can I get from performing my songs for these people? Like, what can I take from them? Which I think is just, that's just kind of part of it from the artist mentality at different points. Because you really work out of this place of scarcity. Most of the time you're like, "I don't know if I'm going to be able to eat," you know, the starving artist mentality. So there's a lot of that mentality that bleeds into when you're up on stage, you know, instead of just giving to your audience, you're taking. And they were one of the first bands we toured with, and they taught us a lot about what it meant to just give to your audience. And I thought that was really important.
Yeah.
Because we've taken that thread with us, you know, through the last 22 years.
That's so really cool.
Yeah.
It's really insightful. So the record came out, but I mean, I went to that, for the record, I went to that tour. I bought that t-shirt that was probably your only merch.
It was.
And I loved both bands, but everyone was there to see you.
Yeah.
How did that happen? Before the record was even out, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people were there to see you guys at every show.
Yeah, it was, I don't think we really understood. We couldn't know. I mean, this is pre-internet, really.
Yeah.
So you're not talking about music being shared in those places. It was literally a DJ would get a hold of a song and would play it, and another DJ would hear it, and he'd be like, oh, that's cool. I'm going to play that too. And people would just start playing it. It was this crazy, I mean, it was viral before viral was cool.
And in a way that is not possible today.
Right, exactly. Yeah, but I don't think we could have, we didn't know what was going on.
Hmm.
The only thing we knew was after the tours we did with PFR, we went on the road with Michael W. Smith,
mm-hmm.
and we were opening up for him. And so we would get on stage. So there were three bands out on that tour. It was another band called Three Crosses, and they would open the show. And then we would play. And after we finished playing, we would get in a van and then drive into whatever city we were in and play a show in some crappy little bar or club.
Really?
For the rock and roll radio station at the same in the same night. And neither venue knew that that there was no intersection between the two. It's like we were a modern rock band in this one world, and we were a Christian band in this other world. And he was the most kind of the whiplash, schizophrenia
mm-hmm.
kind of season for us, going like, okay. And we were just playing the same songs. We only had, you know, 8 or 9 songs that we could perform. So, you know, we were doing the same ones.
Those shows that you were leaving to go play the clubs were arenas.
Yes, yeah. So we were playing in big
10,000
arenas.
10,000 people.
Yeah, yep. And then we would go and play these little clubs. And it's so funny. I mean, and it was crazy because you learn how to perform in front of an arena, and mm-hmm. it's a very different kind of performance than when you're playing in a club. I mean, you're in a club and you can be a little more subtle and brooding. And when you're in an arena, everything is just large and demonstrative, and it's got to be kind of blown over. And so it's crazy that we were kind of learning how to perform in both settings at the same time.
Yeah. Well, because this is a band that hadn't played a show even 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it seemed for at least those first few years there, everything you guys did completely exploded.
Yeah. I mean, that was a powerful season for us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it came with a lot of naivete because we couldn't really understand what was happening. I mean, we were still going, we were making money as a band back then, and we had this business manager. And he would laugh at us because we would walk into his office and be like, hey, we need to buy groceries. Can we get a check for getting groceries? And like, we just had no idea what was happening around us. And that's, you know, that's real. It's a funny story. It's a sad story for a band, though, really, because, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I know that if you're going to step into music as an artist, then really what you're stepping into is running a small business.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't understand what your business is doing, then, you know, your music it's not really going to matter.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, you know, we were college kids, hadn't finished our degree. So we're in that space going, we abdicated all of that responsibility onto other people and just did not take the time to understand the business of what was happening and what our business was. We didn't even know when we were spending our own money.
Wow.
And that was crazy. And this is, you know, this is the 90s when there was money kind of flying everywhere in the music world. And
And you guys were the top of the heap.
Yeah.
Selling millions of records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was a big deal. And, but I think back on that season, I go, oh, you know, I wish we could have paid attention a little bit more. But it was new. I mean, what we were doing hadn't really been done. That kind of traversing both marketplaces at the same time and then trying to navigate how to keep everybody happy at the same time. And like all of that stuff seemed like it was new to us.
Yeah. So let's fast forward from that. You've got the band's done well. You guys have, you know, played all these shows. You've built this huge audience. For a while there, it seems like everything's working all the time. And then at some point, that doesn't keep happening. Not that you guys aren't still making great music or still have a connection with the fans, but somebody else has the number one record. Somebody else has the big tour.
Mm-hmm.
What is that? When does that happen? What is that experience like for you?
That was, That's a really good question. It was really interesting for us to, I mean, it was sad. I remember sitting in a meeting in New York. We were there with our label, and it was right after the release of our second album. Mm-hmm. So Much Afraid had just come out. So we're about 5 years into our career at this point. Because it was about three and a half years between records.
Man, that's a long time.
Yep. We released the second album. It comes out and sells 1.5 million records. And the label guys are going, that was a failure. And they're telling us it's a failure. Yeah. And these are people, because we don't know our business, you know, we're looking to them to validate what we do, because that's all we could do back then. And they're telling us it's a failure. And I think we all took that to heart. And it was just, you know, they were the ones that were kind of coming back to us going, you know what? I know you guys produced most of that first record yourselves, but we don't think you can do it again. We need you to have a producer for your second album. And, you know, at every turning point, it felt like our own confidence and sense of credibility in the music world was being chipped away and the rug was being pulled out from underneath us. And I think that was the big part. And so when you match that with, oh, also now we are selling fewer records than we were, or, oh, not everything we put out immediately shoots to number one. Like all of a sudden we start believing our press and we start believing what people are saying. And then the internet comes into the conversation, because I remember getting the first review that I saw from somebody on the internet when they literally just wrote, "You suck." And I was like, it was so shocking because we had never
got nuance, right?
Yeah. And you're not dealing with some drunk guy in a bar where you're like, oh, that's just the alcohol talking. You're actually dealing with a person who took the time to sit down and type that and send it off.
And like wait for a modem to connect back then. Yeah.
So you're like, what?
It's premeditated you suckness.
Yes. Yeah. And so that you suck was the you suck to you know, heard round the world for us. And it was really hard. No one had really taught us. We didn't know what to pick up and what to put down. You know, accolades and positive things are great to pick up, and you're like, oh, that's really amazing, and I feel so good for you validating me that way. But you realize, I think Maya Angelou is the one who describes, you know, if you're going to pick all that up, then you have to pick up the other stuff too. And the other stuff is just all those crappy reviews or people just wanting to be mean. And it all kind of gets in there, and you start kind of having this crisis of identity, crisis of possibility. Like, I don't really even know what I'm capable of anymore. And can we really make good music? And, you know.
That happened a lot earlier for you than I thought you would say.
Oh, yeah.
I did not realize it was that early. I mean, because that record was huge. You guys were touring everywhere.
Yeah, and that was our biggest touring season, that album. That second album really did a lot better than the first one in terms of kind of the critical acclaim. And I think a lot of that is just everybody's looking at a band going, okay, well, can they do it again?
Yeah.
Can they really write a good song? And we were doing that too, going, can we really write a good song?
More than anybody else, probably.
Right. Yeah. So we were all feeling that. And then the label at that point decided they were really interested in the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC at the time. Those bands were starting to come up. The boy band era was really developing, and we ended up being in this kind of tug of war with the record label because they wanted us to be a boy band.
For real?
Yeah. And they thought, oh, look, these four decent-looking guys, and they play their own instruments, and I bet if we can teach them how to dance, which, I mean, they couldn't. There's no way. But
there were really conversations about this.
There were really conversations. And there were photo shoots even where they would put us in like matching outfits and stuff for certain magazines. And you're going, and we were all looking at it and going, all right, this, we know what's going on here. And we don't want to be a boy band. That's not where we're headed. And so that, even that second album was like, if you listen to Much Afraid, it is this hybrid sound that is very kind of expensive and clean, mm-hmm. Mixed with a bit of this alternative edge. And that was this tug of war going on between the label going, "You're going to be a boy band," and us going, "No, we're not."
That yes, is fascinating. "No, we're not."
Yeah.
So now looking back on that, do you wish you had gone the boy band route?
Yeah, maybe a little. I think at that point, maybe I'd be a better dancer now. And so, yeah,
for you that guys, alone. You guys were famous for dance parties. So.
This is true. We could put on a dance party as long as you didn't get us out on the floor. So, yes. Yeah.
Okay, so, man, that is fascinating. So you guys made a bunch of records. You kept touring. They never stopped. You never stopped being successful.
Yeah.
Just sort of the level of what that looked like maybe became more maintainable?
Yeah, well, and I think we also had to, like, we were either just going to stop, which was terrifying to us back then because we'd been doing music from college.
Yeah.
We didn't know what else to do. There was no other paradigm. We had no idea what the possibilities of, you know, what vocational aspirations or occupational opportunities there would be for us.
Sure.
So when we stopped, we were like, well, we'll all be homeless after this. And... And I think we really were afraid of that, and so we couldn't stop. And so we really had to pay attention to other economies. Like you had to, at some point, you had to turn off the economy of record sales and start going, okay, but what else are we doing?
Yeah.
If we get rid of this band, what is the void that's left? Is there a void? If there isn't, then okay, then maybe we can just shut it down. But if there is part of a conversation that we are helping to facilitate, then let's stay in it.
Yeah.
And let's do that. And that was when like Bloodwater developed and we started paying a little bit more attention to just the cultural conversation we were having. And we had also spent so much time trying to defend who we were as Christians in the marketplace. And it was just tiring at every turn to have people go, you know, questioning who you were and you're too Christian or you're not Christian enough or you're a heretic or, you know, any of this stuff. And you're just like, oh boy, like at some point I want to be able to make music and not have to defend it at every turn.
Oh, that just sounds exhausting.
Yeah. And so you just, at some point we kind of had to shut that off also and just be like, all right, we're going to just continue to write songs and make music and tell the truth. That was our only criteria.
Yeah.
Write whatever we wanted to about whatever we wanted to. As long as we were telling the truth.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah. Which led to some great music.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. So 2003, I was in a band named Cademan's Call. We toured with you guys all year.
Loved that tour,
that
by the way.
That was so fun. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I had been a super fan in high school to now being on tour with you guys, which was for me super fun. I mean, I've realistically seen 150 Jars of Clay shows if I'm...
Amazing.
I mean, that's probably...
I'm honored, really, because I think that's humbling.
Yeah. They haven't all been great. Most of them have been amazing.
I know. Oh, don't I know?
I'll edit that up. No, but I do remember this. There, at one point in that tour, you started wearing this shirt that said Bloodwater. I think it was like a homemade T-shirt.
I still have that shirt in my drawer.
Like somebody had sewn the letters on. Maybe you did. I don't know.
No. It was Matt Odemark's cousin.
Okay.
Who was a fashion design student at the time.
Okay.
And she made me that shirt.
Okay. You wore it, once you started wearing it, you wore it like every night on that tour. I won't ask about the laundry aspects of that, but...
No laundry.
This was before Bloodwater was an organization. It was an idea on a T-shirt. Where did this come from?
Yeah, it was... So we were playing a lot of video games on the bus. At that time, and we were wasting a lot of time. It was kind of this season where, you know, we were out touring. We had a great crew of people doing a lot of the work for us, and so we had a lot of time on our hands. And, you know, at the time, because Jars wasn't, you know, the top of the heap, we didn't have to do as much. We didn't go into a city going, all right, we have a morning radio show, afternoon lunch with the DJ, you know, all of these kinds of things going on all day. So we had all this time. And my wife, Katie, actually, she said, hey, if you're going to be out there and you're going to be away from us and just out there playing video games and stuff, that doesn't feel great. That doesn't feel like a good decision. But if you can be out there, and we all know that you're trying to do something bigger, then that would be really helpful.
Man.
And that was a huge kind of push. So that having that conversation, and then being connected to organizations like World Vision, mm-hmm. and seeing what Compassion was doing and loving what they were doing, but at the same time going, all right, our fans are really in a different place. Hmm. They're not that interested in sponsoring a child for $30 a month. They're more interested in going to places like Africa. Hmm. It was like the rise of this generation that was really the eye rolling and cynicism had stopped.
Hmm.
We grew up in it, and you know, even Bono back then, I remember people going, oh, Bono, just shut up.
Yeah.
And for it felt like we were in the middle of this generation coming up that we were getting to speak to that didn't have that cynicism, that we're like, all right, we see this problem, we want to do something.
Yeah.
But then there were no ways for them to do anything. Bono went around and he did that Heartland of America tour, and he's like, oh, this is awful. There's poverty and disease. All right, see ya. It's like, and he's like,
have a good night.
Yeah. All right. And everyone's going, ah, what do we do then? And so I was feeling that at the same time and really just was like, okay, we've got to find a way to take this platform we have and the people we're talking to and put it to good use.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, there's this poll that had been taken that evangelicals were asked, if they would help somebody with HIV or AIDS, would they? And only 3% said that they would back then. Yeah, it was shocking to think these are people that, you know, go to church. And I know that that's not necessarily the litmus test for who are the most like engaged and
mm-hmm. But that's shocking.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
That was by all regards, shocking. And you go, that's fear. That's fear, not love. And so that was enough for me to hear, to where I was like, all right, this is a conversation we have to have. And so I went to Africa and spent about 10 days there in December of 2001 and just sat across the table from people with AIDS and went to hospitals and met with government officials that were trying to address the issue or cover it up and, you know, things like that in all these communities. And when I was there, I learned about the water crisis because there were a lot of these communities where people were wrestling with HIV and AIDS. Their immune systems were being destroyed, but the only water they had to drink in the community was from some river or a lake or some runoff pool that was created from a trash pile. And all the stuff that was in that water was what was actually killing people. And it made me think, I'm like, well, if people aren't interested in helping someone with AIDS because it's a scary issue, it brings in sexuality, and the way it was reported in the U.S. means that it was more of an obstacle for people in the church to engage with it. I thought, well, water.
Yeah.
I mean, water was, it was such an, not that it isn't complex, but it was such an easy way of saying, okay, well, it's so hard to argue whether or not someone should have access to clean water or not. So,
yeah.
So I came back and talked to the band, and then the band was really interested in what I was saying. So we traveled to Africa together, and they got to see what I saw. And then we came back, and every show after that, we decided we were just going to play on college campuses. And that was where it all kind of went from there. We would rent out a lecture hall in the afternoon and just invite anybody who would show up to come and have a conversation. And that was really the birth of Bloodwater. It just came out of that. And it was just our way of saying, all right, you know, first my wife going, do something important while you're out there.
Yeah, don't waste your time.
Yeah, don't waste your time. And then us going, all right, we feel like this is how we can make a difference. And it just added... For us, there's, you know, every artist I think has seasons where they're out, they're on stage and they're putting on their show, but in their head they're going, why am I here? I could be home. I could be somewhere else. And we had enough of those moments in that season where it just, this gave us something to care about that wasn't just us. It was something bigger and something more.
Man, that's really cool. So at what point did the conversations in college lecture halls go to actually building water wells in Africa.
It was a show out of Six Flags, actually, where we were there. We met Jenna, who was this college girl in Spokane, Washington, and she actually hosted us for an event on her campus prior to a show. And so we did this thing on her campus and then did a concert and then left. And 2 weeks later, I get in the mail this proposal about how she thinks Blood Water should operate. And it's like a 20-page, you know, manifesto, you know. And then a couple weeks later, I get a revised version from her. And I was like, all right, well, this girl obviously has a passion for this.
Yeah.
She's interested. So I got a hold of her and invited her to come to Nashville and see if she wanted to help kind of put a framework around this thing that we were dreaming about and hoping could be beneficial in Africa. And so she came into town, and then she started touring with us. And one night we were out at a Six Flags, and one of our friends was part of an organization, and he said, look, we have a community actually that is in Africa. The drill rig is on the property where they wanted the well, and their funding pulled out. So he's like, we need $1,500 in order to drill this well, and we can do it tonight, basically. So you're not supposed to like ask for money at Six Flags that way. Like, there's certain rules about that they require, and I hated it anyway, because being part of the church and knowing how the church is often known for misusing or abusing money and asking people for money and it becoming part of a greedy endeavor. So so I was like, I don't really want to do that, but it was such a clear ask, though. It was such like, well, all right. So I, Bobby Simmons was a good friend of all of ours. He was out production managing on the tour. And I was like, Bobby, can you go find something to collect money in? And he went out and found chicken buckets. They were literally just these Kentucky Fried Chicken buckets, like you would at an old like country revival. And
making me hungry.
And he just passed them out to a few people. And from stage that night, I said, all right, we've got friends in Africa. And if each one of you put in a dollar, we will be able to raise enough money. And I get to make a phone call and say, start digging. And we raised that night. It was crazy. We were all in the back of the bus counting money, and it's all dollar bills, you know, and little amounts. And we raised $1,552.
You're kidding.
Which was the $1,500 for the well and then $52 for the wire transfer, which is the exact amount.
It was the exact amount.
The exact amount. And so that was the moment we kind of went, all right.
I've got chills.
Yeah. Just crazy. And so that was the last time I had a problem asking people for money that night. So at every show after that, we just said, gosh, why couldn't we do this every night? Why couldn't we invite our audience into helping build a clean water well in a community? So we did it. And we started this thing called the 1,000 Wells Project. And that was immediately kind of, we're going to try to have clean water wells in 1,000 communities in Africa. And it became kind of this movement. Like, we just started raising money, and it was based off of $1 being able to give an African clean water for a year. Which is, you know, magnificent in terms of, like, wow, a dollar doesn't go that far. So, so it was a really cool season where it felt like, all right, this is working, and we have some momentum here, and we started to see that blood water could be, you know, it started to feel like, oh, maybe this is why we've been playing music for the last 10, 15 years, was because we needed to get to this place.
So you're also building a staff, I guess, and you're having to build an infrastructure to handle buckets of money every night that aren't going into your bank account.
Well, and we didn't really know, we really didn't even know how to do all that. So we didn't, I mean, we're collecting money, but we didn't have a 501c3 set up. We didn't have any of these pieces that we really needed to be intact.
So it's just going into some extra little bank account.
Or like into a bag in the corner of our office where we just would hide it. And be like, this is blood waters. Don't touch it. And And Jenna kind of helped us do that. And then we just started pulling people in. We're like, hey, we need help here. Help us out. And we found this collection of people from all over the place. I mean, that's how things start, right? It's conversations. It's relationships. Mm-hmm. You pull people in. And you just say, hey, this is something I'm excited about. What do you think? Are you interested in this? Would you be willing to come alongside of us and help us make this happen? And
yeah,
there were enough people that said yes that it's grown and grown. And now you and I are sitting here in,
yeah,
in the Bloodwater office in Nashville.
Yeah, which has
yeah
10, 15 employees.
Yep.
Here. You yeah. have employees in Africa.
Yep.
You've built how many wells now?
It's hard to
say. I know that's not the right metric.
But yeah, we've helped over 1 million people have access to clean water. Yeah, every one of our projects now is water, sanitation, hygiene, and then it has support mechanisms for HIV and AIDS, and we're doing more work on helping these small grassroots organizations with all of the things they need to become like stable, solid organizations. And so we've learned a lot in the last 15 years about how to engage with people in Africa. And yeah, it's been, I don't think we could have ever imagined that would be one of the things that would come out of jars of clay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So much bigger than 1 million records.
Oh, yeah.
1 million people with water.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you work here now.
Yes.
This is your job now.
Yes.
What do you do here? How long have you been doing this?
So I stepped back in. So when Jars was touring a lot, it was hard to be here and be a part of the organization. And so I stepped out, and there's all, you know, there are very real things like founder syndrome. They have names. It's a syndrome, which means you have to take it seriously.
There's some topical ointment involved.
Yeah, I think so. And really what it is just that it would be easy for a founder of an organization to kind of hold on too tightly and not let an organization grow the way it should. And I was pretty aware of that. And so I didn't want to be that guy. Mm-hmm. And so I stepped out and I just was like, all right, let this kind of do what it needs to do. And it took a few years. And now now that Jars isn't touring, I was able to step back in, and my role is here. It started out just to work with the artist community and to really just say, okay, since Jars isn't a part of this anymore, and I know it was sort of Jars's thing, and everybody that heard about Bloodwater was hearing about it through a Bloodwater show, we need to change that. We really want other artists to take ownership of it.
We need other people to tell this story.
Yeah. So that was kind of my job, was to try to start recruiting artists in and see if there was a place for them to talk about it. But we can't compete with a lot of the larger organizations. So we're not helping people, with speakers and lights and stuff. We're having to kind of just say, hey, if this is something you're really passionate about, please go ahead, help us out. We want you in this. And then that lasted for about 6 months with me in that role, and then I've stepped in a little bit further to do more work with just our donors.
Yeah, so,
which is incredible, because for the life of Bloodwater, I've, as a founder, I've never been that connected to the people that support what we do. Just for a host of a lot of different reasons. But this is the first season where I've actually, I'm the one that's writing the handwritten notes. I'm the one that's shooting the emails off to people and calling people and just saying, hey, thanks for doing this. Thanks for being a part of this really meaningful work. It matters. And it's so fulfilling because, for the first time, I get to understand a little bit more how people came to the organization or why they're still doing it or what their reasons for being generous are. And it's having an effect on me and my own life.
I bet.
It's been great.
Well, and it's probably a little bit like you on stage at Six Flags, where you find out by being in the office that there's a drill rig.
Yes.
And we need $1,500, and you get on the phone and you go find that.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, that's pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just fun. I mean, I know that, a good friend of mine, Steve Garber, who he started the Washington Institute on Faith and Vocation and Education, and he draws these three circles, and one is occupation, one is vocation, and one is passion. And he's like, well, you really want to try to find something that you can do for a living that overlaps a little bit with all three of those. Hmm. I mean, if you're lucky, you'll get that overlap.
So that's passion?
Passion, vocation, and occupation.
And the difference between vocation and occupation?
Vocation and occupation. So I think that your occupation is really just what you do for a living. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing that puts bread on the table, you know? Okay. Your vocation is the greater work you want to do in the world.
Hmm.
Like the bigger story you want to tell.
Yeah.
And then obviously your passion is, you know, is how you would do that.
Yeah.
And so you want those three things to really overlap at some point, and maybe where they overlap is kind of where you want to be. If you're really lucky. When you're a musician and an artist, I feel like we all have the chance to, those circles are almost right on top of each other.
Yeah.
And so there's very little separation versus the guy who works somewhere in an office so that mm-hmm. they can then maybe have time afterwards to do what they're really passionate about.
Yeah.
Which is a hard, I think that's a hard way to live.
Yeah.
And so when I think about Bloodwater, it feels like I was going from being an artist where all three of those circles were right on top of each other.
Yeah.
Going, all right, what am I going to do next? And what if I don't find anything that has that same kind of connection point, that has those three mm-hmm. things stacked up on top? Can I do that?
Yeah.
And the privilege for me right now is that I feel like I'm still getting to do that work where those three things really are connected.
Yeah.
And then, yeah.
That's inspiring. Do you still play music?
I do, only on occasion. So mm-hmm. Jars will still play. We want to be in the room for conversations that are happening that, mm-hmm. that matter. Conversations with consequences, as they say. But it's, you know, we've done some really cool things with, you know, the Freedom Center in Cincinnati, where we've been part of a conversation about, you know, civil rights leaders from Martin Luther King's time speaking into the work of modern day slavery and the effect and having an effect on the people that are fighting against modern day slavery. And, you know, they call us, say, hey, would Jars come and play a couple songs to set the tone for this? We've done things in DC where we've been, Gail Smith from USAID, she called us the USAID house band. Because we would come in and play a few songs before, like, the African Leadership Summit or mm-hmm. Faith Leaders Summit or things like that in D.C. So we love doing music where we can help set a tone for a good conversation.
Yeah.
So we do that. And then just around town, I do a little bit of songwriting. Not a ton, but I feel like it's seasonal for me right now. It is one of my great passions. So if there is one outlier in terms of that's not overlapping right now or out of balance, it would probably be that songwriting space. But I'm just kind of hoping it's just all like it's welling up and at some point it will pull over, you know, it will just overflow and I'll be like, all right, time to get in the studio.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure I know a lot of people are anxious for when that happens again, for sure. So. Yeah. Man, well, this has been great. Thank you so much for your time. And so people can, I'd love to get some links to some of those things you just talked about. I think there will be people that will want to find out about that. So we'll put some links in the page about that. But Bloodwater, if people want to get involved with Bloodwater.
Yep, bloodwater.org, which is great. And if you go back in the blog, I think you'll find one of your daughters, Andy, who is doing some amazing work. She's doing cartwheels and you think that you can't make a difference in the world, and that things are really complicated, but this little girl, she's doing cartwheels and she's actually making a difference in the lives of people, who don't have access to clean water. So that's amazing. So go to the website if for no other reason, just to see what she's doing.
I'll put that link in there too.
Put that in there. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Dan.
Sure.
Man, isn't that dude the best? One of the coolest things about meeting people who you had as you had posters of on your wall when you were in high school, is finding out they're as awesome as you hope they are. Man, that's Dan. He listed a couple organizations and people I want to fill you in on. So the Freedom Center in Cincinnati, you can find at freedomcenter.org. Gail Smith at USAID, she actually now runs the One Campaign, which is Bono and U2 started for aid in Africa, and that's one.org, the word one. And then, of course, bloodwater.org is where you find actually the work that Dan is doing with Bloodwater, which is amazing. And then, of course, there's my daughter, Sadie, Clean Water Cartwheels on Instagram. That's all there is, no Twitter or Facebook for her or anything, just Instagram, Clean Water Cartwheels. And again, for the month of September, any money that you give will be matched. Unbelievable. Let's help her get her goal of $10,000. Anything that you donate through that goes straight to Bloodwater, and it just gets credited to her page. So please check that out. Send a couple bucks. Enjoy a really cute 10-year-old doing cartwheels to change the world. It's awesome. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you, Dan, for making the time. And as always, head over to andrewosenga.com/podcast for other episodes and to get in touch. Now go do something awesome.